Hello and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor of Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guest this week is Todd Bolsinger, author of the book Canoeing the Mountains, Christian Leadership in Uncharted Territory. Canoeing the Mountains has done the rare thing of becoming a popular book in both conservative and progressive church circles. By combining research in systems theory and adaptive leadership, and using the compelling metaphor of the Lewis and Clark expedition, Bolsinger's book has provided a very helpful guide for church leaders trying to navigate rapid change in the 21st century. We talk about all these things in this engaging conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Todd Bolsinger, thank you so much for being on the Failing Boldly podcast.
It's my pleasure. It's nice to be with you.
It would be good. Many people in the church world, I think, have read your book, but for those who haven't, I was wondering if you could just briefly share a little bit about your own background and the inspiration for writing Canoeing the Mountains.
Well, I wrote it at a time when I was a pastor in a church, and I was doing a bunch of work in our presbytery and then our denomination. And so I wasn't writing the book. I was just doing the work on change. And I saw a documentary by Ken Burns on Lewis and Clark, and I just needed a sermon illustration. So I told the story of Lewis and Clark, and it so resonated with people and helped them understand the idea of how leadership has to be different when you get into uncharted territory that I just became a fan. I read a bunch of books. I saw documentaries. I became just studied it, and I know the area geographically because I have a little place in Idaho. So it just became a labor of love, and it just became a really helpful tool.
Did you know, so when you went about writing it, did you go about it thinking, I'm going to talk about change or I'm going to talk about leadership? Partly because I've always appreciated systems theory and adaptive leadership. And so I don't know if others have put those two things together. Maybe they have. But when you did that, that's what really was the hook for me. And so as you went about, was it the metaphor that drew you first, or did you think, I want to write a book about change or leadership?
Mm-hmm. So I started doing change. Like, I wasn't writing a book at the time.
Okay.
I was actually leading change processes. And what I found was I had, you know, basically three arrows in my quiver. I had one was adaptive change stuff. It really was, it was giving a language to the difference of the change needed to make. The other was the systems theory helped me think about the person of the leader and what needed to happen in the life of the leader. And then this story, I love the story because it's a fraught story. It's about these very fallible characters who are doing this core of discovery that is mixed with all kinds of things that weren't necessarily good. It's part of our own historical story that is very complicated, but it was a story about a success in leadership and a success that took a different turn because when they went off the map, they had to lead completely differently than they had on the map, right down to what would have been a military expedition, how it now had to be a lot less militaristic and listening to people like Sacagawea, who were experts that they would never even have considered. I mean, they barely considered her a person. So it became this really interesting, disruptive thing for me that I just was able to probe. I probed it with a lot of groups over a lot of period of time, and that's what became a book over time.
Yeah. I heard you speak here in the Chicago area a couple of weeks ago, and one of the things that you said in the presentation that I saw a lot of heads, well, I should say some heads nod, and almost a sigh of relief in the room is when you talked about the three hardest words for anyone, especially a leader, and those words are, I don't know. Yeah. And then you also talk about how important it is for a leader to lead the learning whenever you're going about change and transition. And so I would imagine that to say, I don't know, or to lead that learning is a lot easier said than done.
I think in one sense, it's really, especially even in a religious context, it's even harder because the expectation for most religious leaders is that they are the expert. They are the people that's experts at soul care. They're the people who are experts at the scriptures. They are the people who understand how to take people through the mysteries of God and the mess of humans, as Eugene Peterson said. So to get to a place where all of a sudden you say the leadership you need, particularly for a church or a religious community, is that you're going to have to lead them through learning, is at first a big disappointment. And so that is So having to weather that disappointment with people is really huge. Be okay with saying, I don't know, doesn't mean I give up. It means I don't know, and we're going to learn together. And what we're going to build on is the trust we have and a vision for our ministry or for the work that we're given. We're going to work ourselves through this problem. And but it's a different way of thinking about the church than is traditionally been used.
Have, in your own experience and in talking to other leaders, do you find that showing that vulnerability of saying, I don't know, actually is helpful?
Well, it depends on the context, right? Mm. I think it's really interesting. I used to always say, I've thought about this differently because of the conversations I've been in. I've had a number of younger leaders and women leaders and leaders of color say to me, Todd, that kind of vulnerability in our setting won't work. Mm. Like you have to have a place that is trustworthy. So I often think about this with younger leaders. I'll often say to them, go to some place where you can learn, where they value learning. And if you're a senior leader, create a context where learning is an expectation. Like it is not a failure if we learn. And that remind people that the word disciple means learner, and that we're going to be lifetime learners if we're going to be people who follow Jesus our whole lives. And then create the context for the safety of learning is needed before people can learn. But so I'm sober about that. But it also does remind people that to overcome overcome the expert expectation is really necessary to keep going into uncharted territory or to lead adaptive change.
I really appreciate you saying that. I have found in the few times I've gone out to talk about failure, and when I encourage people to not be afraid of failure, this has happened a few times, and now it's finally sinking in. Particularly Korean and Korean-American pastors pull me aside and say, that may work in mostly white spaces, but it's harder in the spaces that I'm in.
Yeah. So I gave your book to one of my staff a few years ago. And I gave your book to her because she's one of our most gifted staff. And she tried an experiment we were going to do with trying to reach young adults, and it didn't work. And she was struggling with, I've never failed at anything in my life. And I gave her your book to her to say, look, what I want you to think about is how we reframe failure here. Mm-hmm. And what she was trying to say to me, and at the time I didn't catch it, is she was trying to say, this is not just because I'm a person who's always been successful. It's also because I'm a woman.
Right.
That people look at me differently when I say, I don't know, or if something fails. So it's a very critical conversation.
You talk in the book, in your book about our church to see our current cultural situation as, and I'm quoting you here, an opportunity for adventure, exploration, and transformation. Mm. And my makeup is such that really inspires me. But do you also find, I would also imagine that people find that so scary and paralyzing. And so, again, I'm asking you to draw on your own experiences and talking with folks. Is it a mix of people who both are inspired by that, but also those who are in denial about that?
Yeah, it is. The thing to think about this is that almost nobody goes to, when people get up on a Sunday morning and say, I'm going to go to church, they don't want it to be another disruptive place in their life. Maybe we want it to be spiritually disruptive. Maybe we want God to meet us and shake us out to the core and bring us back to God. But we assume that God can do that in 50 minutes and we'll be fine by the time we walk out, right? So it's a really disruptive. So you have to create an environment that says we're involved in something that is much longer. It's a much longer process. We're well-held. We're well-loved. We have good trust. We care for each other. But we are also going to have to acknowledge that this is not something that we're normally wired for. Even the language of adventure. I did that because so much of the literature about change is like change or die. Well, it's true. If you don't change, some things, especially congregations we love, are going to die. But it's not very motivating. You need to actually give people a reason to, give energy, sit up straight, engage in the conversation, and get themselves fully engaged in the challenge before us.
That's helpful too, because I think in some instances too, you almost have to, redefine church. But if church is a place where I'm coming, where there's sameness and safety and comfort, you have to really think about, all right, what is church before you kind of have these conversations?
Yes. So thinking about the church as a place for us to go on, that we are already going into an uncharted territory. We are going to the places of our souls that we need God to grow us. That we're going to, whatever it's going to cost us to follow Jesus, it's going to cost us our lives.
Mm.
So to continually think about that. I mean, the verse when I often preach on this is I will use the verse from John that says, unless a grain falls to the earth and dies,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't bear fruit.
Mm-hmm.
It remains alone. But if it dies, it bears fruit. And that notion of this process of growth is going to feel like loss. It is going to feel like death. But the promise of going through that is fruitfulness. And so that's an adventure that you need to go through.
Your definition of leadership in the book is energizing a community of people toward their own transformation in order to accomplish a shared mission in the face of a changing world. How long did it take you to come up with that? Is that something that you had a sense of early on and it developed? Or did you know pretty quickly, there's so many definitions of leadership out there. And how did you come up with this one?
Yeah. I wish I had something pithier. It's still a little bit...
An acronym out of it or something.
It's a little wordy. But but I would say that, for me, what it came out of was the understanding that adaptive leadership, adaptation is the way that a living organism in a changing environment thrives. And so leadership is leading a group of people through that adaptation. And that adaptation is ultimately, again, about thriving. It's about doing well. And the challenge usually in front of us is the thing that's keeping us from thriving. So if you think about that, for me, it became a way of beginning to say, leadership is actually as much about leading people through their transformation as it is about accomplishing a goal. Right?
Mm.
I often say that, a sports analogy is that a really good coach doesn't just have a good game plan so the team wins. A really good coach develops people. The players get better and they are the kinds of people who, even if the game plan falls apart, they can do better. And I think some of what we need to recognize is that leadership is always a formational piece. And for me, this brought together, this was my life as a pastor. I mean, my PhD was in communal processes of spiritual formation. And I remember teaching a doctor of ministry class at another seminary, and they called it Leading Communities of Spiritual Formation. They just gave that title. And I went in with all my curriculum for that week was on community and spiritual formation. But all the students who were all pastors wanted to talk about was the leading. How do you actually lead people into community? How do you actually lead people into spiritual formation? And that disrupted my thinking. And that's actually from there is where I began to do the pivot toward actually writing about this.
Really paraphrasing here, but along these kind of definitions of leadership, I know in your book and also when I heard you speak, the sense of leadership is moving someone along at a rate or disappointing somebody at a rate that they can stand or something like that. And that seems like that's along with what you were saying too.
Yeah. So Ronald Heifetz is the one who said that leadership is disappointing people at a rate they can absorb. And what's great about that is it acknowledges, and when you say that, people immediately get it. Oh my gosh, that's what makes leadership hard, is that the very people you're leading who ask you to lead them are going to be disappointed with you. If you do it too fast, then they're just going to kick you out. They're not going to follow you, right? If you don't risk disappointing them, then they will never change. So it has to be a disappointment that is paced around and in a way that people can absorb it, grow from it.
Well, we talked about failure a little bit ago. And so certainly you talk about it. One of the other tasks of a leader is to help go create a culture that experiments, innovates, and adapts. And of course, that comes with, when you do that, failure happens. And so I want to read one quote that you have from your book about failure. And you said, if we want to make sure that we learn the lessons from our experimentations and innovation, then we need to fail with as much credibility and competence as possible, which I love that wordplay. What is your experience in working with, when talking about failure and in talking with churches and organizations?
Yeah. So there's this, this is actually one of the pieces related to what we talked about earlier, right? So if I go through an experiment and it fails, or we try a new change and it fails, the first response, the default response of people is going to be, well, that person just didn't do it right. It was incompetent or that was a terrible idea. What we're trying to do is actually you're trying to put kind of the scientific method back into it. We're trying to say, okay, let's hold two variables. If we're starting with really competent people and we're starting with people with great integrity, they're congruent, they're trustworthy, then if we do an experiment with those people who have high trust and it doesn't fail, we actually do a better job of learning from it. We go, okay, So the greatest example of this is when I talk to pastors who are wanting to lead adaptive change. And if I go talk to their leadership boards or their session or their deacons or trustees, and they come and talk to me and they say, well, I think the real problem is they need to work on their preaching. Well, they will never get the chance to lead change if their preaching is bad. Mm. They just won't. People will say, look, before we go through that pain, what if you do a better job of preaching? Or if you say, you know, the problem is people don't trust them because that person isn't really very caring or very attentive or they're not very present. No one's going to follow you. I would say this, no one's going to follow you off the map if they don't trust you on the map. So if you're not technically competent with the things you've been entrusted to do, and if you're not congruent as a person who cares for people and shows up in the same way, then it's pretty hard to lead them to follow you into the I don't knows and the unknowns.
It ties in a little bit with when you talk about a leader's emotional process, about staying connected or starting being convicted, staying calm and staying connected. Mm-hmm. And is that also partly around competence too? And in helping organizations and churches walk through this?
Yeah. So that's a little mantra from the Lombard Mennonite Peace Institute, Peace Center. So, you know, start with conviction. That's the part that I added to it. Stay calm, stay connected, stay the course. What's great about that is when people experience you as being competent. So I'm competent in managing my own emotions, right? That's an interesting thing about how much emotional intelligence is really important these days. So the pastor's not just mad or insecure or angry. The pastor is managing their emotions or his or her emotions. And then you stay connected. I can manage the relationships. So you're disappointed it's not working well, but we can have a conflict. We can have a disagreement. I mean, I had a faculty member in my office today. She and I are very good at having strong disagreements with each other. and we trust each other really well because of that, right? And then staying the course is a way that people then trust that when you're staying to your plan, it's not because you're stubborn or because you're not listening or, you know, because your ego's on the line. It's because you actually have a conviction about that plan and we're going to give it more time to see if it works or not. And they trust you that if it's not the right plan, you will learn from it. You'll come back, you'll learn, you'll adjust.
Do you have leaders come to you and ask you, how do I increase my emotional intelligence? And if so, what do you tell them?
Yeah. So it's interesting. This is actually one of the most, I think this is one of the most fascinating parts about the most recent brain research. You know, most of us, you know, I'm in my 50s. We grew up in a world where IQ is fixed, right? You can't really do much about your intelligence. Just do the best you can. EQ, emotional intelligence, everybody says is not fixed. I mean, so it starts, you know, Carol Dweck is famous for having developed what they call a growth mindset. So just starting with the notion that I know I can grow. One of my students called me today. I teach online for master students and he's in the East and I'm in the West. And he called me to say, look, I'm learning all these things from these books we're reading about cultural intelligence and cultural identity. I didn't grow up in an environment. It was very homogeneous. Nobody I know ever talks like this. I feel so stupid in my class. Mm. And I went, just the fact that you can own that you know you have a blind spot and that you know you need to learn is a sign that you are learning. That's really different. Most people, especially white males, get really defensive as if they're being picked on when what you're saying is, I know I feel stupid and I just don't want. So what happens is then giving people the freedom to know they can get better, then there actually are ways of growing in self-awareness and of getting mentoring and getting feedback from others and beginning to, you know, learn the kind of key elements of emotional intelligence that you can be trained in.
Yeah. And it's a sign perhaps to say that I need to grow in this area. And that's what a great first step.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. So, you know, the first thing is self-awareness, right? Sure. Self-awareness is the first part of emotional intelligence. You know, this is why I often say that people who can't reflect really can't lead change very well. You can be a good engineer. You might build the best bridges. You might be a good even, you know, tactical leader. You can run the right plans. But reflection is really important, especially reflection to the place of self-awareness and vulnerability. Mm. It's critically important to be able to lead people through adaptive change.
Another moment in your talk a couple of weeks ago when I could sense people nodding and just murmurs of agreement is when you talked about sabotage. Mm. And of course, church leaders have all kinds of experience of dealing with challenging folks in their parishes and churches. Can you talk about talk a little bit about what you talk when you talk about sabotage, but also when people say it's so hard to not take it personally. Mm-hmm. And I emphasize in the book that to say, don't do that. But it's so hard to not to, especially when people try to do all they can to stop you from leading with conviction.
Yeah. Yeah. So whenever I talk about sabotage, it is the topic people want me to talk most about. So I just finished the book I just turned in that will be coming out next year is on the resilience to survive sabotage. That's the next topic. And the reason for that is because it's the number one thing people want to talk about. So three things become really important. Number one is normalizing it, that sabotage is normal. It's what a human person does to try to restore equilibrium. It's like trying to restore the status quo. So I always say that's really important to know that it's normal. It's going to happen. You know, Ed Friedman talks about it happens 100% of the time, right? It's also normal because, and this is when I say the best way to understand sabotage is that sabotage is not the bad things that evil people do. Mm-hmm. It's the human things that anxious people do. What anxious people do is they return home. They return to mama. They return to what's familiar. And, you know, there's a connection between the word family and familiar. So you go back to the ways in which you coped with your anxiety, and that ends up being sabotage. And then the third part about that, noticing about sabotage, is that the way to deal with it, the best way to be able to deal with it, is to separate yourself from your role. Mm-hmm. So even as a here at the institution at the seminary, I'll often say, you know, people here think Todd's really great. The vice president and chief of leadership formation is changing a bunch of stuff. They're often mad at him. And it's my way of just joking and realizing that no one's mad at me.
Yeah.
They're mad at me like they're mad at the referee in a soccer game, or they're mad at the coach who benches them, or the whatever, like it's role stuff.
I think that's my guess is it's particularly hard for pastors because we place so much of our sense of who we are and our vocation, and we attach language like I'm called to this. Mm-hmm. So many pastors talk about how they resisted that call. Mm-hmm. They finally kind of threw up their hands and said, okay, God, I'm following you on this. And so their identity and what they do with who they are so tied together. And so I would imagine that for clergy, it's really hard to separate those two.
Yeah, it's true. One of the things I often talk about, I talk about this in the new book, is in order to lead change, you need to have an identity that is grounded in something else, something other than the success of the change.
Yeah.
You've got to be able to say, look, whether we are able to make this change, whether I'm able to lead these people through the wilderness to the promised land, depends upon them and God. What I'm going to do is be faithful to my calling, which is to be in this role, to do this thing, to be with them, to accompany them, to be faithful to God in the middle of that. And so it's really hard, especially, and I would say that for pastors over a long period of time, the congregation shapes and forms us by their affections. You know, I mean, you come out on a Sunday morning and you preached a good sermon, people will tell you they love you. Like, maybe that's only in California, but people would literally say to me, you know, Pastor, we love you. We are so glad you're here. We pray for your family every day. I mean, I never said that to my plumber, the guy that fixed my car, my lawyer, like, yeah. You know, but so people pay us not only our salaries, but they pay us an affection.
Yeah.
So to be able to recognize that sometimes that affection is going to be withheld because we're leading them through where they need to go and resist going is pretty important.
Yeah. It can be addicting at times. I mean, to really, I reflect on that. What you just said, I reflect on days that I get, you know, a text of affirmation or an email of affirmation. And I realize like this doesn't happen in every occupation. In fact, it happens pretty rarely.
Yeah.
It's not a benefit necessarily, I guess, but it's what makes it harder when people withdraw that or take it away.
I would say the hardest part about the Heifetz definition about disappointing your own people at a rate they can absorb is the phrase your own people. Mm. There's a lot of folks I'm willing to disappoint, but my own people, like the people who called me to be their pastor, the people who call me pastor, the people whom I love and raise my children amongst, oh man, that's excruciatingly hard.
Yeah.
And yet that is what I'm called to do. I'm called to lead them.
Yeah. Well, I always end these conversations with folks and asking them to share a failure story from their own life. And so I was wondering if you could do that, whether it be personal or professional, whether it happened yesterday or a few years ago.
Yeah, well, actually, you know, I wrote about it in the book, so this isn't a very hard one for me because I've processed it a lot over the last few years. But I mean, I led a huge initiative for my denomination, and it started with lots of expectation that we were, I mean, literally, we had people say this could be the most important commission in 100 years. We are going to try to reframe, you know, the entire notion of what discipleship looks like and missional communities look like in the 21st century. And we passed a motion. Our committee worked as hard as we could. We had all kinds of engagement and buy-in, and we took it to our General Assembly, and it lost by more of a margin than Barry Goldwater lost. They got creamed. And I thought a lot about that. And partly, you know, some of that was the state of our denomination at the time and the anxiety about other issues. Some of it was are things I just didn't know. Like one of the things I learned through that, it's become really important, is that, you know, it's not the best idea that wins. I mean, change doesn't happen because you have the right idea. Change happens because the right idea combines in the right time with the right people who are willing to go through the changes they need to go through. And I just believe that because we had this amazing document that everybody would just rise up and vote for, that was going to be enough. And it was a sobering experience. And it was also my first time of dealing with systemic sabotage. I mean, there were people who, the very same people who asked me to do the work, didn't support it, even after telling me they would. And at first that made me hurt. And then I realized, oh, that was part of my own leadership problem. I needed to help them not have, as everyone calls, a failure of nerve. I needed to work with them and stay closer to them. And I didn't know how to do that at the time. So, yeah.
How long did it take you to get, I don't want to say get over it, but how long did it take you to kind of respond to that, reflect on it, and move on so that it wasn't really affecting you in a negative way?
Well, I would say that in one sense, the best part about that failure is that it actually corrected. It was the right kind of learning for me. It was a costly learning. They say you should learn fast and learn cheap, and that was not fast and that was not cheap for anybody. So what I needed to learn is how to learn, speed up the learning loops and more inexpensively. But what it did is it actually taught me, one of the things it taught me is that genuine institutional change doesn't happen through structural change. It doesn't happen through intellectual argument. It actually happens through the changing of people and the changing of emotional processes and changing of culture, and that's going to be a much longer thing. And so while knowing that, you know, actually this is where learning actually helps me to get over it. Once I have a sense of that was painful and slightly embarrassing, and I still feel it today. I see people from those days, and I'm profoundly aware that I wrote a book on leading change. And it's everybody's favorite chapter is the chapter about where I couldn't. So I'm profoundly aware of that irony, and I feel a little bit aware of it today. But the grace of it is that I did learn through it, and I'll let others learn through it too.
So the book coming out next year, you said, is about resilience. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's resilience and leading change. It's
okay.
It's basically, what is the formational practices that enable people to develop the resilience to lead change?
We look forward to that. Todd, thank you so much for taking time. And again, so grateful for your book and for other opportunities to learn with you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Nice to be with you.
And that's this week's episode. Thanks again to Todd Bolsinger for giving his time for this conversation. To learn more about Todd's books and research, you can go to fuller.edu/faculty/Todd. That's TOD-Bolsinger. Or you can also follow him on Twitter. That's at Todd Boll, TODBOL. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to christiankuhn.com. Thanks again for listening.